This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. E-cigarettes have become popular, especially among young people, but are they any safer than cigarettes? Coming up, a researcher will share who's more likely to use e-cigs and will consider their impact on health. Are they as addictive as cigarettes? More later this hour. We'll also check in on a situation that has affected thousands of Connecticut residents who receive assistance through the State Department of Social Services, or DSS. Late last year, a California-based vendor was awarded a three-year, $140 million contract to provide non-emergency rides for sick adults and children on Medicaid. But state residents and advocates say the vendor is hard to get a hold of and has caused patients to miss important medical appointments like dialysis. Turns out this vendor has run into issues with another state, so why did Connecticut award VAYO this contract? We'll learn more with the reporter from The Day and hear from an attorney at the Center for Children's Advocacy that's coming up. And first, we're going to actually talk about something that shocked many of us late last week, and that's the story of homes in three different Massachusetts communities exploding or catching fire. Now, federal authorities continue to investigate the cause, but Massachusetts emergency officials say the explosions were likely caused by overpressurization. Now, does your home use natural gas? Do you wonder if a similar situation could happen here? You can join us, 860-275-7266. You can email us, where we live, at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Joining me now in studio with more on this story is Luther Turmel. He's a reporter for the New Haven Register, part of Hearst, Connecticut. Luther, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We know that state and federal authorities are still investigating these explosions that happened in Lawrence, Andover, and North Andover, Massachusetts. What's the latest? Do they know the cause yet?
Well, the last that I read yesterday was that they have federal officials investigating, and that it could take a couple months before they have a preliminary finding. But they said a final finding could take up to 2 years. I mean, they want to be very methodical, but I mean, you know, I think that we could see a preliminary finding before the end of the year, because obviously people want to know what's happened, and if need be, hold the utility accountable in Massachusetts, Columbia Gas.
Now, there's a company that many of us are familiar with. Eversource has been brought in. Governor Baker has asked them to lead recovery efforts on the ground. So exactly what is Eversource doing?
Well, I mean, and I should say that for people who don't follow this, I only do because I'm this is what is my job. But it was pretty much unprecedented. Governor Charlie Baker declared a state of emergency, and the reason he declared a state of emergency was so that he could bring in Eversource to lead the recovery effort. Otherwise, that would have been left to Columbia Gas. And, you know, even in the early stages, you know, while they were still putting out the fires, I think that the local officials and Governor Baker were dissatisfied with the responses that they were getting from Columbia Gas. So Eversource is coming in. I mean, you're having some of the workers, the repair crews are coming in from Connecticut. Eversource also has a natural gas operation in Massachusetts. And they will lead the effort. When I spoke to Mitch Gross, the spokesman for the company, on Friday, he said that at this point they don't know how long their people will be there for, but that, you know, they're there to do the job, and they're also getting some help from the two utilities, or actually the multiple utilities owned by Avangrid. Southern Connecticut Gas and Connecticut Natural Gas here in Connecticut are also sending crews to Massachusetts.
Now, in a statement from Eversource, they're very clear to note Connecticut systems are not connected to Columbia Gas system, obviously because of the questions of whether that company, Columbia Gas, was negligent in causing these explosions. So tell us, what do we know about Columbia Gas?
Well, to be honest with you, because they don't have any companies here in Connecticut, I would really be at a loss to say anything about them. I know that in looking over what's been reported thus far, I mean, they've had some problems that a couple TV stations in Massachusetts have reported. They had a problem in West Virginia. But, you know, it's I would be remiss to say anything more than, you know, what I've seen other media outlets report. So,
When we think about these explosions that happened in Massachusetts on Thursday, then we've seen news coverage that there have been similar incidents around the country. One of note in 2010 in California. What happened there? Were dozens of homes also exploded or caught fire?
Yeah, I think it was like three dozen homes. There were eight people that were killed. And this San Bruno is probably one of the more well-known. I mean, it's near San Francisco. And ultimately, it was determined that PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, the utility out there, had cut some corners. And nobody went to jail as a result of it. I mean, you didn't have executives going to jail or anything. But they got a fairly significant fine. It took 7 years to sort everything out. Which I guess isn't too encouraging for the people of Massachusetts, but yeah, I mean, it was something that, you know, I guess you could argue was negligent. I mean, they didn't do what they were supposed to do. They didn't spend the money that they were supposed to spend.
So when we look at these natural gas explosions, the New York Times reported since 1998, 646 serious gas distribution incidents, that's what they're called, causing 221 deaths, nearly 1,000 people injured. This is all information from the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, the federal arm that's also investigating what's happening in Massachusetts. What are the common causes of these explosions, Luther?
Well, I mean, I don't think that the numbers break it out, or maybe they do, but I haven't seen a breakout of the numbers. I mean, there's a couple ways that natural gas pipelines have problems, and some of it has to do with the lines being punctured by backhoes. Before I came to Connecticut, there was a fairly significant explosion that only ended up killing one person in central New Jersey, the Durham Woods explosion in 1994. And somebody hit a distribution line with a backhoe and blew up an apartment complex. I mean, that's critical to, you know, it's one thing when you have too much pressure being put into pipes that aren't appropriate for that level of pressure. I don't know what the breakout is, but that's one of the ways. And I mean, to a large extent, you know, I've been at the register for 20 years and covering utilities for most of that. Connecticut Natural Gas Companies, the collective, the three big utilities, have a fairly good safety record. It's. I don't think people should really be worried, but I think by the same token, it helps to be aware that these things can happen.
Luther Turmel is a reporter for the New Haven Register, part of Hearst, Connecticut. He's on Where We Live today as we look into this story out of Massachusetts, where two towns and a small city in Massachusetts all dealt with explosions. At the same time, Columbia Gas was doing, routine work on the pipelines. And Luther, I've seen reports that when we think about infrastructure, Massachusetts has some of the oldest infrastructure in the country. And so you mentioned that here in Connecticut, the company, Connecticut.
Well, there's three. Okay. There's Southern Connecticut Gas, Connecticut Natural Gas, and Eversource, which is the former Yankee Gas before Eversource ever existed.
But. And they all have good safety records. But in terms of our infrastructure, talk us through how that's maintained, and because people have questions.
Well, for starters, I'd actually like to jump ahead for a second. I mean, the state Utility Regulatory Agency, Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, or PURA, has a pipeline inspection unit that does about 500 inspections a year. When the utilities do rate cases, when they go before the regulatory agencies to seek rate increases, they provide for them details in terms of what work they've done already and want to get reimbursed for, and what work they plan to do in the future. This the big effort now is they're replacing metal pipe with what essentially is PVC pipe. Now, that may seem kind of odd. You may think that the pipes that are made of metal would be safer, but according to what the utility people tell me, that it's the PVC pipe is less subject to corrosion, and so they go and replace a certain number of miles of pipe every year.
You can join our conversation here on Where We Live, 860-275-7266. Marianne's calling from West Hartford. Marianne, go ahead.
Yes, I had a situation about 5 years ago when there was a big push to get persons to convert from oil to natural gas heat, and we were one of those persons who did that. It was a nightmare. It was apparent that the company who was doing the conversion was overextended and undertrained to meet the demand that all the publicity generated. We ended up actually having oil contamination from our old system seeping into our new system, much more complicated than that. It was contaminated with carcinogens. It took us forever to get that situation straightened out. Later on, I found out that the big push was because the natural gas companies were looking forward to improving infrastructure, exactly the problem in Massachusetts. They were hoping to pass on the cost to customers, and hence the push to get more and more people signed up as quickly as possible. To the credit of the Connecticut State Legislature, my understanding is that they blocked that effort. I do not trust the natural gas industry one bit, and I do not trust the situation, and it is an extraordinarily dangerous product, and if I had to do it over again, I never would have converted.
Thank you, Marianne, for your comments. Luther, did you want to respond to what Marianne was telling us?
Well, she's right about the expansion part. All of the utilities earlier in this decade presented a 10-year expansion plan. Part of it is because they're looking to make money, to make more money. And so they're expanding the distribution network. I'm not sure exactly what she was talking about as far as the legislature putting a stop to it, because quite frankly, the legislature approved it, and it was an initiative that Governor Malloy and his then utilities commissioner, DEEP commissioner, were wholeheartedly behind, because the price of natural gas has gone down significantly to some extent because of the fracking that's been going on. The natural gas is closer to us and has to travel a shorter distance. And so the price of natural gas has gone down, and that's why they're doing it. But I understand why people are nervous about it. I mean, it can be dangerous. But and you know, it's unfortunate what happened with what she was saying.
Now we've got a tweet from Patty Luther. She writes, "In West Hartford, our gas is being upgraded to high pressure. Will this be on hold? Do we know anything about the work being done there?"
Well, I don't know that. I think it's probably too soon to say what Connecticut would do. I mean, I know that Massachusetts, the Governor Baker has been talking about expanding natural gas service in eastern Massachusetts, and there's been some speculation that would be put on hold for a while, that the legislature there would have a difficult time moving forward with it. But as far as Connecticut, I mean, typically people are more reactive than they are proactive. And I don't see that would necessarily be put on hold, because the legislature and the regulatory authorities don't have any evidence that the incumbent utilities have been doing anything wrong.
Before we head to break, you know, another question on people's minds, Luther, is if an accident can cause this much damage, how severe would it be if someone intentionally sabotaged gas lines? Let's talk. Is that a legitimate concern? And who's looking into that?
Well, see, that's the thing. The thing that's interesting about that is, understandably, companies don't want to talk about what kind of security measures
sure.
that are in place. But on the other hand, there's so many pipelines, not just the distribution network, but the transmission network. I mean, we have three different transmission networks coming through parts of Connecticut. I mean, I guess it's a legitimate concern, but to be honest with you, I don't know that you're ever going to get the utilities and or the state or federal government to say, here's what we're doing to protect the pipeline. But certainly, you know, there's a lot of pipeline. Most of it is below ground. But sure, if somebody wanted to do it and wasn't afraid to give up their life, because that's the other issue, you know, how would you trigger the explosion? How would you set off the destruction of the pipeline? Somebody who's willing to sacrifice their life, yeah, I guess it's possible. But the details, you know, as far as the protection levels, I don't think you're ever going to get anybody to discuss that.
Luther Turmel is a reporter for the New Haven Register. Luther, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, thousands of residents on Medicaid depend on transportation services to get to important appointments. But reliability has been an issue after the Connecticut Department of Social Services awarded a new three-year, $140 million contract for those services to a California company. We're going to find out more after the break, and you can join us too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Earlier this year, a California-based company began serving thousands of Connecticut residents on Medicaid, both adults and children. VEO was awarded a three-year, $140 million state contract to provide non-emergency rides for sick residents. But these residents and advocates say the vendor has been hard to get a hold of or rides haven't shown up, causing patients to miss important medical appointments like dialysis. Turns out this vendor has run into issues with other states. So why did Connecticut award this contract to the particular company? Joining us now to explain is Martha Shanahan, a reporter covering health and the environment for The Day. Martha, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks.
So tell us a little bit more about VEO.
Yeah, so VEO is what is called a transportation broker. And it fulfills a service that is a benefit that has been given to Medicaid members since the Medicaid program was first started in the 60s. VEO took over.
Oh, I think we lost Martha. Let's see. Martha, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Now we can hear you. Go ahead.
The contract, basically, as the middleman between the state and the sort of organizing the rides and matching people who need rides to their doctor's appointments up with a taxi or an ambulance or a wheelchair van to get them to their doctor's appointments. And that started on January 1st.
So tell us a little bit more about the company that was doing this service for the state of Connecticut. Why did they make the switch?
There was another company called LogistiCare, which had been fulfilling that role for the state for several years. In around 2016, advocates for patients legislators and some other people started advocating for the state to start reconsidering which company it was using for a few different reasons. I understand there were some complaints about the service that company was providing, including, I believe, that they were giving rides to children whose doctors had said that their immune systems were compromised, so they couldn't be in a car with another person, and they were violating those rules and giving them rides with other people and sort of sharing rides. So that led people to push the state to go out to bid for a new company, and that process sort of ended in 2016 when they put out a request for proposals and considered 5 or 6 different companies and chose Veo.
Now, we'd mentioned earlier that Veo, this California company, had also had contracts in other states, and there were some issues, I believe, in Idaho. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Veo had the contract with the equivalent of the Department of Social Services in Idaho to provide medical transportation for that state's Medicaid population. After Connecticut chose Veo as the broker in Connecticut, they ended their contract with Idaho. It's a little ambiguous what exactly happened there. Neither the state nor Veo has really said exactly what happened, but from news reports coming out of Idaho, it sounds like a lot of similar issues were happening than we see in Connecticut, including people being left for long periods of time at their doctor's appointments or never getting picked up to go to the appointments in the first place or being on hold for extensive periods of time.
Joining us in this conversation about Veo, again, this company that's been contracted to provide non-emergency transportation services to patients on Medicaid that includes adults and children. Martha Shanahan's a reporter for The Day who told us a little bit about the context surrounding this and how it came to be. But right now, Bonnie Roswig is on the line. She's senior staff attorney for the Center for Children's Advocacy. Bonnie, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me a little bit about what you've been hearing from patients about Veo.
So it's been an incredibly difficult time for patients, really, since the beginning of the contract. So you have to understand that this is $160 million that Veo is receiving, not only in terms of administrative costs, but they upfront get the cost for the cabs themselves. From September 15th, 2016 to December 31st, 2016, they got almost $1 million. That's $941,000 to set everything up to make sure they had all the patient information and all the information regarding what cab companies to use so that they were to be good to go, as we say, as of January 1st. This was a contract with the state of Connecticut, and they contracted the state had to ensure that that Veo was prepared as of January 1st. As of January 1st, it was a disaster. People were waiting on the phone for 3 hours. Dialysis patients weren't being picked up. Rides weren't coming. People in wheelchairs were not getting wheelchair rides. It was hugely problematic. And remember, these are the sickest and most vulnerable people trying to get to the doctor. I mean, this isn't something that somebody has a choice about. It's really to get to fundamental medical services. So it's been incredibly difficult, and the service has not been good. And it was a similar experience in Idaho. Many, many problems. There were many news reports of incredible difficulties in terms of performance by Veo, and ultimately efforts by at least from the news reports and talking to advocates in Idaho, they worked to try and remedy it, and then ultimately they parted ways with Veo.
Now, can I ask you, Bonnie, we reached out to Veo in a statement. They wrote, we've seen significant improvements in our call centers. We just completed a 4-week retraining of all agents on protocols and customer service. Our average speed to answer is 45 seconds. And they're also now saying in the statement, we're hearing positive feedback from the majority of stakeholders across the state. So I'm curious, between January and now in September, have there been improvements?
So I have to say your call gets picked up sooner. than it used to. People are not waiting 3 hours as they were, you know, for many months. But the rest of it is not because Veo did anything particularly proactive, but because the state on some levels forced them to comply with the contract. So, for example, Veo was refusing to transport anyone who needed a wheelchair from January 1st through July. The state said, you know, you have to do that or we're going to, you know, potentially find you in breach of the contract. But, you know, why the state didn't insist that that happened beforehand, I have no idea. And I have no idea why the state's allowing Veo to do this. In terms of all the wonderful improvements they've made and the retraining, they talked about that last week at a legislative committee where the whole system had been retrained. But in the month of August, I had one client who suffers from muscular dystrophy, has a prosthetic leg, and, you know, was told that they weren't going to take her by cab anymore and that she had to take a bus. I had another patient who was a paraplegic, and they just didn't give him rides at all. And I had a third patient who suffers from kidney disease, who again was told that, you know, we're not going to give you service anymore. And you have to, you just have to figure it out on your own. So all of these very serious, very specific, issues for, again, the sickest, most vulnerable patients has happened since that supposed training. Mm.
This is Where We Live. On the phone with us is Bonnie Roswig, senior staff attorney for the Center for Children's Advocacy, also a reporter for the day, Martha Shanahan, as we look into a situation with thousands of Medicaid patients who rely on non-emergency transportation services. The state contracted with a California company that service began in January, and there have been a lot of issues since then, as we've heard from our guests. You can join our conversation, too. Maybe you rely on Veo. The number 860-275-7266. Sue's calling from Monroe. Sue, go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to discuss my son's problems with Veo. Unfortunately, my son had to stop attending his Extend program because of Veo and their complete disregard for his safety.
So tell me what was going on.
Well, they, from the very beginning, they would show up with drivers who I couldn't communicate with because they didn't speak English. Another time, like the first week, the driver picked up someone else in the car with my son in the car. Now, my son has emotional disorders, and he has, he's very paranoid, and he gets very upset very easily, and it upset him. It actually made things much worse for us. And the times that we didn't have an issue was when they didn't show up. They would show up maybe 3 times a week out of the 5 times. They went to pick him up at school one day early and then left because he wasn't there, even though they were instructed to wait for him. He was at the school by himself for an hour. The last final straw was my son was in the back seat of the cab. They were driving to his program, and the cab driver picked up another woman who was complaining about having the flu, and my son had a PICC line in his arm that went directly into his heart for medication, and they picked up a woman who had the flu while he had this in his arm. And that, to me, was the final straw. And I called them every single time there was a problem. I called San Diego and spoke to the head honchos over there. They promised that they would fix it, and when they didn't, they ghosted me. They totally just disregarded my calls, my messages. And when you call Veo, their headquarters, you can't get through to a human being. You know? So, and not to mention that Veo was incredibly reckless with my son's safety, is the fact that I called the state every time as well, not just Veo. And the state's only words to me were, we're investigating the issue. We'll call you back. Not once did they return my phone calls.
Well, Sue, we have someone on the line from the State Department of Social Services. If you could hold the line, I want to bring into the conversation David Dearborn, who's spokesperson for the Department of Social Services in the state of Connecticut. David, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lucy. Thank you.
I'm sure you're able to hear from this parent, Sue in Monroe, about issues that she had with Veo transporting her son who had a medical condition. Can you talk about how the state has worked with state residents to alleviate these concerns?
That certainly is a horror story, and it's not excusable, as are some of the other complaints that have been described on the show. Overall, there have been improvements. Veo has demonstrated some improvement. Many of the advocates and hospital representatives, for example, I think would validate that. But we're still 9 months into the program. There's a long way to go. Transportation is one of the most difficult services that Medicaid programs deliver, not just here but in other states. And over the last decade, we've had multiple contractors. We used to have a regional system. Then we went to statewide logistic care, which Martha discussed. And a couple years ago, we started redesigning the system. We put it out to bid, state re-procurement. Veo, actually Total Transit out of Texas with Veo, won the procurement, lower costs, more technological solutions. There's been problems, no doubt about it, but the system is evolving, and we believe that gradually it's getting better. We're 9 months into this. The verdict's still out, but it's getting better.
David, we heard from Martha Shanahan and others about Veo having issues with a contract they had in the state of Idaho. I mean, how did the state do a good enough job vetting this company before awarding this $140 million contract?
I think Idaho popped up after, and, you know, eye of the beholder, you might want to talk to Veo about that. I think Veo's standpoint would be that maybe the state of Idaho changed some contractual parameters that they didn't agree with, but we're more concerned with what's going on here in Connecticut.
And then as far as what Sue, the mother, had said when she called the state, she didn't get any kind of response. I know that, this is something that residents are working with Veo in terms of getting appointments and if there's no-shows, but could the state be doing a better job responding to residents here?
Well, Lucy, I think we could always do a better job. I don't know where Sue called. You could give Sue my phone number, and I'll personally expedite. I do know that our staff that oversee the contract do a lot of complaint troubleshooting and resolution. It's a constant job. They work closely with Veo. Again, we're seeing some gradual incremental improvements, so we're looking at things positively, much more positively than we were at the outset of the scenarios that Bonnie just described.
Bonnie, you're still on the line. Again, Senior Staff Attorney for the Center for Children's Advocacy. Did you want to respond to David Dearborn's comments?
Yeah, we still have major, major issues with the state's oversight of the program. I mean, the bottom line is the state's responsibility to make sure that Medicaid patients get transportation. The stories that I related, you know, news stories come in constantly, weekly, and it's just still not working. And so the state needs to make sure that Veo, you know, does their job, because at the end of the day, these are federal monies, and the state is required to provide Medicaid recipients this service. So one, they need to radically bump up their oversight, and two, they need to think about within the contract, the contractual language is that if, you know, it goes to the benefit of the citizens of the state of Connecticut, then they can either end that contract or extract, you know, portions of the contract and give it to someone else if Veo isn't doing their job. And the state really needs to look at doing this, because we just are not seeing the improvement that needs to be done. I mean, 9 months is a really long time. Veo claimed that they did this in other states. You know, why is it just not happening? Why are people being told, you know, why are people who are in wheelchairs being told that they have to take the bus? This is just not acceptable.
David, did you want to respond before we take another call?
Well, I think we're doing just that. I think it's a challenging task. 4 million rides a year. We've had complaints about this program, as other states have had complaints about their programs. well before Vail came along. The same things that Bonnie's talking about virtually, she was complaining about during the previous contractor. And it's a difficult, difficult program. It is not something that we flip a switch and all of a sudden we have the performance that we want to have. So we're working on it. We don't disagree with her, much of her premise. We disagree with some of it. We can't just turn a battleship around and break up a contract. There'd be chaos, more chaos in her eyes, and there would be pandemonium. And so there always is a difficult transition period. We're past the transition period. Incremental improvement is happening. But when we look at the past, and I know the past is not today, but there is no panacea when it comes to medical transportation programs. LogistiCare, based out of Atlanta, took a bunch of hits from us and the advocates. Bonnie complained to the federal government about LogistiCare. The feds kind of threw that out, but the problem was there was problems there. And previous to LogistiCare, we had a regional solution that wasn't the solution, so we got rid of that. So it's a constant work in progress. We believe we're getting there.
Can I just say, the federal government investigated that case. They did. They took that very seriously in the complaints, because what's really fundamental to this is protecting the rights of people with disabilities. Vail and LogistiCare weren't doing that, and it's concerning that the state isn't ensuring that continues to be done.
I wanted to bring back into the conversation Martha Shanahan again, who's been covering this story for the day. We heard from a listener. We've also got another call earlier before the show. These are the similar complaints that you've been hearing from residents, Martha?
Yeah, and somewhat less so as of recent, but I have continued to reach out to folks who started calling me in the first couple weeks of January, with similar complaints that sound a lot like what they were describing. They're somewhat less severe, and people have said in many occasions that the service is getting better and that they're starting to see some reliability coming from Vail. But in other instances, they're saying there are other problems, or they are. And I think a lot of people were, they lost a little bit of trust in the system. And Sue mentioned that she had stopped using Vail altogether because she felt like she couldn't trust it. And I think a lot of people are still sort of, every time they go to call Vail and to try to schedule a ride, they can't be sure that it's going to come. So I think there's still a certain level of uncertainty there.
Well, I want to thank David Dearborn for joining us earlier on the show. I wanted to go back to Bonnie Roswig, Senior Staff Attorney for the Center for Children's Advocacy. Bonnie, what are you going to be looking for in the weeks ahead? Because we heard David Dearborn say that they felt like they were in the transition period and there are improvements. And then he kept saying that transportation for this amount of people can be difficult, but that's not comfort for those who are waiting to get to their appointments, and like Sue and Monroe, whose child, had an issue and a severe health issue, and was, taking a ride with somebody with the flu, possibly.
Right, correct. We are everyone has had experience. One of the major problems with LogistiCare was that the state didn't do the appropriate oversight to ensure that LogistiCare did the transportation correctly. We were very vocal about that and very concerned, because as a bottom line, people are suffering. Dialysis patients have to get to their dialysis. People in mental health treatment programs need to get there. Children need to get to chemotherapy. So we were very vocal and very concerned. When Vail got the contract, it was our hope that the state would really step up and ensure that the contract was complied with, and we just haven't seen that. And at the end of the day, it is the state's responsibility to make sure that happens. They have committed to the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid Advocacy Services, rather, that transportation will happen. That's the basis of the receipt of the federal monies, and we're just not seeing it. So Yeah, it was the same with Logisticare because it's our feeling that the state didn't do their job, and we continue to be very concerned that the state is continuing not to provide the requisite oversight.
Bonnie, we got to end this segment pretty soon, but I guess the question is, could litigation be something that comes down the line if you don't see those improvements?
Well, you know, we need to make sure that people's, you know, rights are enforced, and we're looking at all avenues.
Bonnie Roswig, Senior Staff Attorney for the Center for Children's Advocacy. Bonnie, thank you for joining us. Also, Martha Shanahan's a reporter covering health and the environment for the day. Martha, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, are e-cigarettes a healthier option than cigarettes? And how popular have they become among young people? Coming up, a researcher will join us to talk about a recent study of e-cigarettes. Should health providers and parents be concerned? We're going to find out right after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. This month, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration sent warning letters and fines to retailers who've been illegally selling e-cigarettes to minors. FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb says it did so after, quote, clear signs that youth are using e-cigarettes at, quote, epidemic proportions. There's a researcher who's been looking into e-cigarettes, and he's joining us now by phone, Dr. Andrew Hyland, Chair of Health Behavior at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York. Dr. Hyland, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us more about e-cigarettes. They've become popular over the last couple of years. How are they different from the traditional cigarette?
Yeah, so e-cigarettes are, they deliver nicotine, but they heat it rather than burning like cigarettes. So it's really that simple. E-cigarettes are a much simpler mixture, usually nicotine with some flavors in a solution, maybe propylene glycol or vegetable glycerin, and that's pretty much it. It's heated, and that releases the nicotine into a gas, and then the user breathes that in. Unlike cigarettes, which you burn the tobacco, there's thousands of chemicals, dozens of carcinogens, and including nicotine that goes into the body, and nicotine. Yeah, is the agent that makes people keep coming back.
Now, for parents who are listening, these products, these e-cigarettes, are often sold under brand names like Juul and Blu and Logic. So are these something that are used widely among both teens and adults? Or, you know, I'm just curious about when they've come into popularity and who's using them.
Yeah, so e-cigarettes are relatively new technology. In the U.S., we see around 2011, 2012, when the use rates really began to increase. In kids, there's some surveys that show that actually more kids are using e-cigarettes than cigarette smoking. And we also see, you know, fairly extensive use in young adults and older adults as well across the board. So it's really this kind of rapid uptake in the use of a product, e-cigarettes, that has caught the attention of a lot of people.
And how are they marketed? So retailers are not able to sell them to anyone under 18?
Well, that differs in different jurisdictions. Cigarettes across the board throughout the country, you need to be at least 18 to sell cigarettes to consumers. E-cigarettes right now are in a bit of a regulatory gray zone because they are new products. They're not covered under a lot of the existing federal or state legislation that might exist. So the minimum age laws are, some states have them, some states don't. In terms of how they're marketed, it's really across the board. Some e-cigarettes are marketed to help adult cigarette smokers quit smoking, but we also see lots of evidence that they're cool, hip, attractive flavors, colors, that some think that may be looking to attract a youth market into the mix.
You mentioned because it varies from jurisdiction and because they're so new, is that why these advertisements aren't restricted in the same ways as how cigarette manufacturers can market their products?
Yes, that's essentially it. I mean, there have been some recent developments in there with the FDA, which now it's been not just not even 10 years now, just under 10 years since the FDA has had regulatory authority over tobacco products, is their marketing and their the products themselves. E-cigarettes are a late addition to that mix. And just recently, well, within the last couple of years, they're not supposed to advertise e-cigarettes toward kids, so that's a no-no. And then very recently, e-cigarettes are now required to have a warning indicating that nicotine is addictive. So these are steps in the direction of being more consistent with other cigarettes in particular, but there are still, because these products are new and the regulation basically hasn't caught up yet to where the cigarette legislation is.
I've also read that these products, these e-cigarettes are not, they don't have as many toxins as, say, a traditional cigarette. But tell me about your study and whether or not there's a relationship between the nicotine levels among young people because they're using them more frequently.
Yeah, great question here. Certainly the e-cigarettes, because they don't burn the product, they heat it. There's far fewer chemicals that come off of an e-cigarette than come off of a cigarette, where there's literally thousands of chemicals and dozens of carcinogens. So cigarettes are absolutely a dirtier, more toxic product than e-cigarettes. That doesn't mean e-cigarettes are safe. It just means that they have less bad stuff in them, often a lot less bad stuff in them. The particular study that our group at Roswell Park did is, to our knowledge, it's the first study to look at Juul-specific data. Juul is a relatively new brand of e-cigarette, and it has really gained market share. More people report using Juul than any other brand of e-cigarette product. And there could be some reasons for that. There's some chemistry of how they formulate it. It appears to be better than other products. It also could be some of the marketing as well. That hasn't been really teased out, but those are a couple of reasons. But the particular study we did, we surveyed a bunch of kids on Long Island at Stony Brook Children's Hospital and asked them about their use of e-cigarette products, including Juul. And then we also looked at their urine and for a specific biomarker of their exposure to nicotine. So they basically a test to see how much nicotine they had in their body. And what was surprising is that these kids had levels, these Juul users, they only use Juul, they had levels of nicotine that were comparable to cigarette smokers. Which indicates that they're definitely getting a lot of the nicotine out of those products. Previous brands of e-cigarettes are not particularly good at delivering nicotine. Cigarettes are very efficient, the way they've been designed and engineered to get the nicotine to the user, but Juul seems to kind of mimic that process. So the takeaway of that study is these kids that are using Juul have just as much nicotine in their body as kids that smoke cigarettes. And, you know, the concern is that the exposure to nicotine, one, is a long-term exposure. There's uncertainties on that, but then could this be priming those kids to become not only addicted to nicotine, but then subsequently become cigarette smokers? Again, that dirty, toxic delivery system of cigarettes, and that's what we want to try to avoid.
So definitely alarm among use of these e-cigarettes among young people. But you mentioned earlier, and we only have about a minute left, Dr. Hyland, but e-cigarettes are seen as a good transition for adults who are trying to step away from smoking.
There are definitely a lot of anecdote. I know I run our smokers quit line for New York and New Jersey. We help tens of thousands of people quit smoking. I hear a lot of stories about adult cigarette smokers that say that e-cigarettes help them get off of cigarette smoking, which is fantastic. If I had one message to say, is don't use cigarettes. If you smoke cigarettes, do whatever you have to do to get off of them. And if you don't, if you're a young person or you don't use cigarettes, don't start. That's by far the most dangerous thing that's out there. So in terms of these products and how they can be used to help adults. There's still needs to be more scientific studies that are done. There's some that are out there that suggest that.
And Dr. Hyland, we're actually going to have to leave it there. We're going to link to your study on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Dr. Andrew Hyland, Chair of Health Behavior at Roswell Park in Buffalo, New York. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Carmen Baskoff and Kion Wolf.